Hola amigos, this is Don Alejandro de la Vega. Welcome to Tropical Paradise Waits. Do you ever dream of living in paradise? Dream no more, my friend. If you are planning on living in the tropics, or if you are a full-on expat, this show is the show for you. Listen and learn how to make the best of your leisure time. It takes more than a plane ticket to fully enjoy the tranquil lifestyle. It is a state of mind. Let's live a better life. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Positive reviews help us rise up the ranks. Please scroll down and click support this podcast. Gracias, and enjoy the show.
The United States embargo on Cuba has been intact over 60 years now. Now, during that whole 60-year period, were people able to go back and forth to Cuba? Well, yes, they were. Some people very easily, without any problem, and as often as they like. Just how'd that work? Stay with us. I'll tell y'all about it. Hey, are you rethinking your life? There's never been a better time in history to retire or work remotely right here in paradise. The tropical real estate listings are right here. We know the protocol and we can point you in the right direction. So if you're interested, just send me an email. The email address is printed in the episode notes. Live on tape from Studio B and from the seat of my pants in beautiful downtown Cabaretti, Republic Dominicana. Out of 5 million podcasts, you found Tropical Paradise Waits. I'm Franco. So how did that work? Well, Key West is a small community. And in Key West, the authorities live amongst the people. And a lot of the authorities are of Cuban descent. So just like any other community, you get to know each other. And as long as they knew that you weren't smuggling drugs or guns or something like that, they would just turn their cheek and let you go back and forth as many times as you wanted to visit your family or bring supplies. And it wasn't just the upper class of people. I mean, I myself saw street performers that I've seen on Duval Street in Cuba, or I'm sorry, on Duval Street in Key West. I've seen them on the walking streets in Cuba. And today's guest is Christian. He's lived and he continues to live a wonderful full life, and he's a really intelligent, interesting guy and a friend. I have him back, and he's talking about his connection from Key West to Cuba, and he's talking about cigars. This is a guy who lives it and who knows the life, and it's something that I've seen and I've always questioned. Hey, I'm back here with Christian. He's a great storyteller and a really interesting character, and I had him on the show a couple weeks ago. We were talking about Key West, and we segued into Cuba. I believe we left off, you were talking about the house Fidel Castro lived in, and a friend of yours,
right,
dated his daughter,
one of his lieutenant's daughters, and didn't mind at all, as I said, I think the last time, and you had to be met at the edge of these three concentric circles that are it was kind of part of his compound, and he used to go down there several times a year for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. No problem. We didn't have any problem at all. We got around. One of the things I did on the back of the motorcycle of the guy that owned this boat we went down on, and we would go to various neighborhoods, and we went to Mariel, where the boat lift took place in 1980. It was a Mariel boat lift, and we wandered around there, and we found a whole stack of Mao Tse Tung's red books that some library had thrown out. So we figured at that time, well, communism was going to be out the door. If some library had the guts, it wouldn't be guts if it was going out the door to throw these things away. And it was one of these places where the Cubans had also dug tunnels like they had in Vietnam and to protect the shoreline in case it got invaded by Americans. And so we were seen around there, and we got reported. And so this was shortly before I left, and the police came looking for me at the boat. But I had already left the boat and gone to the airport to go back by plane.
I don't understand. What was your crime? What did you do wrong?
My crime was I was seen in where the tunnels were.
Oh, okay.
Even though there was no sign saying restricted area, but I was still seen there. And I flew on a plane through the Bahamas and back to Miami and then Key West. And I took a couple of boxes of cigars, needless to say, Cuban cigars. And when you leave the Bahamas, you check out with American Customs in the Bahamas. You don't check with in Miami. And so they say, this woman asked me, do you have anything to declare? And I said, well, I bought some Cuban cigars. And she said, anything else? I said, no. And I said, you know, it's Cuban cigars, okay? She said, go away, go. No, they weren't okay.
But she let you go.
But she let me go through anyway. She didn't want to do any paperwork and right. Stay overtime.
Really, all you have to do is take the rings off, right?
Yeah, that's all.
But you kind of want that ring on there to show it.
Well, but it still had the box.
Yeah.
So here's something, a key if anybody's buying Cuban cigars on the beach here. Cuban cigar boxes are not wrapped in plastic wrap and cellophane. Yeah. And they don't have windows on them. They don't have that. So anytime somebody says, oh, these are Cubans, that's a foolishness. And here in the Dominican Republic, nobody's about to import Cuban cigars since we have our own. And we do have very good cigars. I used to go to Nikki Beach when they're in here in Cavarete, and he could meet quite a few important, well-to-do people because Nikki Beach was not cheap. And one of the people I met was the president, I think, of Aurora Cigars, and I told him how I had visited the cigar in the early 2000s, his cigar factory, and I was impressed by the fact that the cigars were tested every 100 cigars or so that somebody made was tested to make sure they had a good draw in it. They were taken to a room and then lit and then put through a machine to make sure that the draw was good. It wasn't tight and it wasn't too loose. And he said, we used to do that with 10% of the cigar makers. Now we do it with everybody. But I also told him this, that I thought his cigars were much better than they were back in the early 2000s. And he said, yes. And the reason is we want to make a good cigar, because when somebody is paying $10 for a cigar, they deserve a good cigar and you don't want to lose them. Now in the restaurant business, we have the same attitude too. We want to have a good meal for the people. In the restaurant business, we have this saying, it is easier, less expensive to keep a customer than it is to get them back. And that goes with any kind of a business. You want to make sure you have good customer service. So what else I say about Cuba? The girls are very friendly, and they don't necessarily have to do with being a puta. Again, everybody is very accepting. Right now, I can't think of any other stories about Cuba. So for the moment, oh, yes, there is. So we have a Coast Guard base down there. And one of their jobs is to go out with these vessels of theirs and all year long collect Cubans trying to get over to the United States on rafts. And they collect a certain number of these people and then take him back into Havana Harbor. And it's an agreement with the Cuban government to let these boats in. And Lord only knows what happens to the people that try to leave. You know, maybe they try again. And so I was talking to one of the Coast Guard guys once, and I said, I suppose you know everybody's supposed to be starving in Cuba. He says, yeah, that's what we're told. And I said, well, when I was there, there was quite a few people who were overweight. He says, we were talking about that recently because we were taking people off these rafts. And they weren't skinny and dying. Quite a few were overweight. So we have in the United States, we have a certain amount of propaganda on the part of the press. During the Mariel boat lift, 1980, Cubans, Key West, before 1980, had a winter season of 3 months, and that was it, nothing else. And with the Mariel boat lift, people were driving down, Cuban Americans from Miami, with trailers with their boats on them and putting them in the water to go to Cuba to pick up their relatives, because Castro said you can come and pick up your relatives. And those that didn't have boats came down and rented a fishing boat with a captain, gave them a couple of $1,000 to go down and come back up. And then when they went down, they had to take up more people than just people that were relatives. One guy had a cigarette boat. Those are those big, super fast boats. Yeah, and he went down and picked up his relatives, and he said to the guards along the docks where he would pick up these people. And he said, well, okay, but first you have to take back strangers. Then you can come down and pick up your relatives. And it was there that Castro was emptying out the criminals. And the insane criminals from his prisons and sending them to the United States. And so at that time, Jimmy Carter was president and Bill Clinton was governor of Alabama, I guess it was. Carter had sent these people to Alabama to special camps. But in the meantime, the Department of Justice had seized any boat returning from Cuba, figuring that these people were going back and forth every other day making money. The fact of the matter was they weren't. And they put them on the piers in the old Navy base and with a security guard to protect them. And lo and behold, a security guard didn't do much because people would pilfer these boats. And on government property, and these boats turn into a mess, and the government never reimbursed them. But Clinton was ticked off because Carter had sent all these immigrants to him. And I was driving a taxi for this Mariel boat lift. I had picked up a bunch of newsmen and taking them to different spots where they could see what was going on. And I said, well, I'll take you out to the Navy base because I had a pass. And then one of the spots we went to is where the boats were going into the water off of these trailers. And then when we got out to the Navy base, these same boats were coming out of the harbor. And the guy said, he was in media. He was taking videos. He says, I just love this stuff. And I just happened to be there at the right time. It's an astounding sort of an observation dealing with cities and towns on borders. If you go to France on the Rhine, and there's Germany right across the way, and the small towns and the small cities in Germany are kind of half French, culturally and in language, and on the France side, and part German. And right next to each other, you know, almost a stone's throw away from a different country. But here we are in Key West, and even though 90 miles separates Key West from Cuba, Key West has a West Indian feel, a West Indian culture. And so as I was beginning to say about these Cubans coming down to Key West with its Mariel boat lift, people in Miami discovered that Key West was a lot like home. The streets had sort of potholes, the sidewalks were gnarled and they were pushed up by the roots of trees, you know, mahogany trees and palm trees, just like back home. So it had the character. So instead of a three-month season, suddenly we had an all-year season, except for a little bit in January. So that Mario Boatlift sort of helped us with that. I wanted to make another observation about these boats and these people.
Well, when people, I've been to Cuba a few times, and people ask me to describe it, and the best way I describe it is it's the closest country to the United States that's not attached by land, and it's the most different. There's just no place like Cuba.
No. And there's a... We had a thriving cigar industry back when cigars were handmade in Key West. And a lot of people came up from Cubans. And the reason we had this in Key West, even at a time before the railroad connected the mainland with Key West, is because cigars were taxed by the federal government, but tobacco wasn't. And so you could ship in tobacco and make cigars in the United States, whether it was Key West or Tampa.
Were they bringing Cuban tobacco?
They were bringing Cuban tobacco. And they were taking Cuban tobacco. The last of it went to Tampa. And there was one ship that went down every week and came back to Tampa with Cuban tobacco. That was what was rolled in Tampa.
That's how Ybor City got built.
That's how Ybor City got built. And I was a stockbroker in New York, literally on Wall Street. I was still able to get Cuban tobacco cigars from Tampa, and there's a difference. Interesting too, there were some cigars made in Fort Lauderdale. I lived there for a while, and one time somebody gave me four cigars from Nicaragua and Robustos. Nothing to write home about. And they were a little Ziploc bag, which was open, and I put them on a table next to my door, and then accumulated mail was on top, and I cleaned this thing off one time, about 3 months, and I decided to light one of these things up, even though they weren't particularly good. Now they tasted like a Cuban cigar. Now, why was that? It is because the molds and the funguses and the bacteria that came up with the Cuban tobacco to the cigar makers in Fort Lauderdale was still in the air and in the walls of the buildings that had gotten around and then had infected, so to speak, these cigars. And so these little microbes is also really what makes a cigar very good and very tasty.
I used to get cigars from a warehouse in Ybor City. And there was always a few people in line, and I'd wait in line and take care of business. And there was a little old man worked there. And one day it wasn't very busy, and I got talking to him. And guess what his name was? Arturo Fuente.
Is that right? Really?
Actually, Arturo Fuente. And I asked him, I said, why are you still working? He said, well, he said he retired, and he got a little boat, and he was going out to lunch with his wife. And he said he realized he would rather be right there selling cigars and talking to guys like me about cigars. He said that's his life.
And these cigar factories, no matter where they were, had a reader at the front of the room. And while you're rolling cigars, there'd be a guy who read the newspapers from Cuba and from New York, a newspaper to the world, and he would read a Spanish literature, Don Quixote and such. And so all these cigar makers got an education while they were sitting there rolling cigars.
I was told that one time they took the readers of the cigar factories, and it was almost a mini revolution. People wouldn't work until the readers came back.
Yeah. The cigars, the mold that we people make cigars use today, that wooden mold, didn't exist. It wasn't from time immemorial. The Indians didn't use something like that. There was a big effort in the late 1800s to make more cigars. There was a greater demand for cigars in the United States and in Europe. And a fellow by the name of Oscar Hammerstein, he owned theaters in New York City, And he used to finance the buying of buildings to convert to theaters by making inventions. And one of his inventions was the cigar mold. And so the cigar mold was invented by this German immigrant.
You're talking about the two pieces of wood?
The two pieces of wood.
A circle on each side. And, right. And I think they clamp them together?
Yep, they clamp them together. And it helped to make cigars with somebody who was less talented at the rolling of the cigars.
And then they put the wrapper on later, right?
No, the wrapper was put on.
They put it all on, and then they clamp them in the mold.
You know, you got a point there. It's been a long time since I've seen one of these things, but what you say makes sense because the wrapper is very thin and very inexpensive. And I had a friend that had a small cigar store in Key West. It was on a corner. It was an open store, and he had a Cuban rolling cigars. And he would buy Connecticut wrapper,
Connecticut shade,
which was very expensive and also very hard to come by because the big people had bought out these farms. And so one day he met somebody that had a wrapper farm in the Connecticut River Valley. And he said, I'll send you down some of my wrappers. Interesting thing, it is shade grown. And in the Connecticut River Valley, you have a situation where it's very flat land on both sides of the valley. And in the morning, the humidity from the river would accumulate under these shade sheets. And it made a high humidity when the sun came up, which tobacco likes. And it was to emulate the climate in Indonesia. Well, why in Indonesia instead of Cuba? Don't know. I never found out. But you go to Indonesia, and guess what they're using over there? Wrapper fields, shade things, to, I guess, make it more Indonesian. I have no idea. But these shade farms are small because you can't use any insecticides, or if you do, very infrequently, because otherwise the flavor would be picked up. And so these guys go out every morning, maybe tops, they have 3 or 4 acres. That's it. And they go down every row inspecting all the plants to see if there's any bugs and then do something to kill them with a very mild insecticide. And these leaves are very, very, very thin. Interesting, too, that one time I had asked the roller, I said, well, if the leaf, the wrapper is so important for the cigar, it's what gives it its flavor. What if you make a cigar entirely out of that same tobacco?
Interesting question. And what if?
And what did he say? He said it would be terrible. I said, but it makes the cigar, it's the important part. He didn't make it terrible.
I've always enjoyed that Connecticut shade.
Yeah, so you got the filler, which is just an ordinary tobacco. You got the binder, which holds it together. And then you have the wrapper that holds the whole thing together. And he made a cigar for me entirely out of wrapper. And guess what? It was terrible. Yeah. And so the Key West, though, full of character. Borders, even though it's 90 miles away from Cuba, it has a lot of that West Indian feel, which is a great thing about Key West.
Thanks once again for coming back. I really appreciate it. You're a great storyteller.
Well, it's the big bucks that brings me.
You know that. That's right, man. Yeah. You know that. It's getting better and better every week. Thank you, Christian.
Yeah. Franco.
I've been so far around this globe that if I kept going, I'd be on my way back. In Cuba, it's the most different, most unique, and the favorite place I've ever been. When the civil unrest settles and travel becomes easier, I'm really looking forward to returning. Smart people, listen to podcasts. Tell your friends. Google us. We're at the top. Tropical Paradise Waits is presented by Elusive Media. New shows launch every Sunday. I look forward to hearing you listen. Hasta la semana. Que viene. Adios. Ten cuidado, safe release. Ciao, baby.
Today's credits are as follows. Thank you to our program director,
Don Alejandro de la Vega.
Our editor and fact checker.
They'll never know.
Our chairperson.
Wilma Butfit.
Fleet managers.
Lisa Carr.
Our charm consultant today is...
the always charming Miss Inga Tooth.
Tiki Bar Reviews by...
Hassan Ben Sober.
Our favorite divorce attorney...
Carmine, not yours.
Our credit counselor is...
Max Stout.
And our fashion designer today...
Hugh Jass.
And of course our download counter...
Adam Ilion.
If you enjoyed the show, help us continue by scrolling down and clicking support for this podcast. You know, man.